It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the Green Bay Packers start their season in Chicago on Sunday with a game against the Bears. A reporter shares his analysis of game day arrests and ejections from Lambeau Field as football season kicks off.
First, scientists in South Africa welcomed a new species into the human family tree this morning. Its name, Homo naledi. It's slim, stands at under 5 feet tall, with feet and hands similar to humans and a brain a third the size of ours, according to researchers.
The bones of at least 15 individuals were found together in a remote cave, suggesting maybe ritual burial ground. The more than 1,500 well-preserved bones and teeth represent the largest, most complete set of its kind ever found in Africa.
Two University of Wisconsin researchers were on hand during that excavation, paleoanthropologist John Hawks and doctoral candidate Aliyah Gortov. Steve Paulson, executive producer of WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge, spoke with the two researchers, and he joins us now to share their story. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
It is a pleasure to be here.
So in terms of pre-human ancestors like this, Lucy is the most famous, an ancient intact specimen. Comparatively, how big a deal is this new Homo naledi find?
It's a very big deal. For one thing, I mean, Lucy apparently, there was only about 40% of the Lucy skeleton that had been found. And in this new find, they found 15 skeletons, mostly intact. 15. And I should say that there are still many more bones down in that cave chamber. I mean, they've only just begun the excavation.
Now, you spoke with both John Hawks, the paleoanthropologist involved, and Aliyah Gortov, who did a lot of the excavation for specific reasons, mm-hmm. which we'll find out about this discovery. What did Hawks have to say about the significance of this new find?
Well, it's significant for various reasons. One is it's the biggest find of ancient hominin fossils ever in Africa. And, of course, it's worth remembering that we came from Africa. I mean, our species originated in Africa. So any find in Africa is a big deal. And there's just so much there. And it's a new species. I mean, as far as they can tell, I mean, they're sort of piecing together the, you know, pieces of these skeletons, and there's nothing else like it elsewhere. So it's a brand new species. So that's pretty amazing. I mean, part of the thing that's interesting is there are some parts of the species that look kind of like us and then others that are totally different. And so John Hawks says, we really need to rewrite the story of human evolution.
And you had the thrill of speaking with Hawks about this, and you brought in a little for us to listen to. Do you want to tell us what we're going to hear?
Sure. So, I mean, he's talking about how what he learned in school is kind of going out the window in terms of the story of evolution. And so, you know, here's what they're concluding.
Maybe 15 years ago, certainly when I was a student, we thought that the transition from early hominins that we call australopiths to our genus, Homo, was an event that was accompanied by a change in the way that we walk, a change in the way that we deal with culture. We started making artifacts. We developed technology. That change was tied to a change in diet. We got smaller teeth and we ate higher quality things. We shared food. We began to relate to groups of people in a tighter way with more cooperation. And that meant that the brain got bigger. And all of these things were closely linked to each other. And the fossil record, the archaeological record, seemed to support that. Looking at Homo naledi, its skull looks a lot like the skulls of other early Homo types of creatures, Homo habilis and Homo erectus, except it's too small. The brain hasn't increased in size in a way that humans have. It walked like us. Its feet are the most human aspects of its anatomy. It manipulated objects. We see that their hands were apparently well made to make things. And its teeth look like they were made for a high-quality diet. They're more human-like in some respects than Homo erectus, Homo habilis, for certain. But other parts of its anatomy are strikingly primitive. Its hips are australopith-like. They look nothing like the hips we've attributed to Homo before. Its brain is so small, it tells us that these things that we thought went together as a package actually happened separately, and maybe in separate branches of our evolutionary tree.
That was paleoanthropologist John Hawks talking about this new find in South Africa, Homo naledi. Steve, where does that name come from?
Naledi means star in the local language, and this refers to the whole cave system where this find was, the Rising Star Cave System, which is a little outside of Johannesburg in South Africa. And there's a particular chamber where these bones were found, the Dinaledi chamber, so that's, they sort of dropped down into that chamber to recover these particular fossils.
And as we talk about this new find and what it means to the question of where we come from, in this story, one of the more exciting aspects, at least at the beginning, is how these bones were ever excavated in the first place. Tell us a little bit about what you know about how researchers accessed these bones in this remote cave.
It's a great story. So there's a very active caving community in South Africa, and some of the cavers contacted the famous paleoanthropologist who actually led the study, Lee Berger, and said, you know, if we see anything, do you want to know about it? You know, if we see things that look ancient, you know, maybe human-like, and he said, absolutely. And so there were a couple of cavers who had been in this cave, and it had been explored before, but one of them dropped down into this little tiny crevice and realized, oh, you could crawl down a little bit more, and then realized it looks like there's something down there that looks sort of human-like. And so Lee Berger mounted an expedition, and has actually sort of a fascinating story, put out a notice on Facebook saying, looking for small, ideally female archaeologists who don't mind fitting into very tiny spaces, could drop everything at a moment's notice and go to South Africa for a month.
And one of the respondents
was Aaliyah Gertoff, who is a grad student in anthropology here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she went. And it's an amazing story. I mean, the reason why you have to be so small is there are tiny passages that you have to squeeze in. I mean, the tiniest being 7 inches. There's a chokehold 7 inches that you go down. Wow. And we have a bit of tape from her. Shall we hear it?
So let's take a listen as we talk to WPR Steve Paulson about the finding of Homo naledi in South Africa.
From the outside, the cave is not much to look at, honestly. It's just a hole in the ground. But as you descend, it becomes darker and darker, and you begin to have to squeeze between the walls. Then later there's a crawl through a very narrow tunnel, and that opens up into an area where the only way to get where you're going is to crawl up a fallen ridge of stone from the ceiling called Dragon's Back. And that's a technical climb. We actually hook in with harnesses to get up there. Once you get up Dragon's Back, you have to wind your way around steep, deep holes, and then you enter a fissure that drops 12 feet. Now, it's a very tight drop. What we're talking about is the choke point that required such small-bodied people. The narrowest point in that chute is about 7 inches. Yeah. So the good thing is that most of our bodies are mostly made of squishy stuff. It was cool. The stones were a little bit damp, but the temperature was really perfect for working in. So as you move through the space, it gets more and more silent, and the air gets still, but it smells good. It smells like dirt, like just after a rain, that kind of dampness. And it smells ancient. And the only thing you're hearing is the swish of your coveralls, the scrape of your feet against stone or dirt, and the sound of your own breathing.
That sounds incredible, and also like something I would not choose to experience willingly. But
I have to say, as someone who has a bit of claustrophobia myself, this would be a nightmare.
Yeah,
for
you're
me.
Not alone, my friend. But thank God there are people who can do that, because
yes,
we have finds like this. Now, before we let you go, Steve, one of the big mysteries here was, why are these bones here? What do we know about that?
Yeah. Well, apparently this is not a pit where people fell in. It's not something where it looks like predators dragged these humans in, because the bones are pristine. The skeletons are largely intact, so there is no evidence of violence, and this suggests another explanation. And again, we'll hear from paleoanthropologist John Hawks.
We believe the most logical explanation is that Homo naledi were bringing bodies to this place.
You're talking about some sort of burial site.
You know, that's a tough word for us. It is, because it's natural, right? It's natural to say, well, they respected this place. They were bringing the bodies there. They cared about it. It's some sort of burial. But As from the science side, of course, we don't know what they were thinking. The bodies were not intentionally placed in graves. We know that these bodies were taken there by someone who knew this chamber and who did it repeatedly. That implies a kind of cultural knowledge, and it implies some sort of recognition of mortality. Maybe that's all it implies.
Of course, the huge questions are, was this part of some religious ceremony? Was there some belief in an afterlife?
Yeah. And as an anthropologist, those are the things that most engage me. And it is important for us not to overinterpret. We don't know what Homo Naledi knew. We can't imagine that there was some sort of ceremony that we're talking. We're not talking about a religion in a human sense. We're not talking about something that we recognize as having the trappings of belief as humans have it. You know, I think we're not looking at that.
So you're talking about rituals, but you're reluctant to use the word religious along with that.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, we know it was repeated. It had importance of some kind. But we don't know that it was symbolic, that it had a component that was beyond the ordinary that required a belief, a communication system, the things that religion in humans is built on. We just don't know. And for me, it's certainly something that makes me really meditate about what were our ancestors doing? What were they thinking? And where was our place in this with creatures that had, in some respects, very human-like behaviors, but were not themselves humans?
And Steve, just very briefly, what are the big questions science needs to answer about Homo Naledi?
One of the biggest is, when did they live? They don't know. They don't have a clue. It's the usual way of dating fossils has so far eluded these scientists. So they say they could be 50,000 years old. They could be a million years old. A huge question.
Big question. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
We've been talking to Steve Paulson, executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge. This morning, a group of researchers, including two from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, announced the finding of a new human-like species. You can catch the entire To the Best of Our Knowledge episode looking at this and other human ancestors here on the Ideas Network at 1 p.m. this Sunday, as well as on ttbook.org. This Sunday is the season opening game for America's favorite football team, the Green Bay Packers. They'll be playing the Chicago Bears Sunday at noon.
One aspect of the games that fans at home may not think about is the unruly behavior of fans in the stands at a place like Lambeau Field. The Gannett, Wisconsin media investigative team just did an analysis of the people arrested or ejected from the stadium over the last bunch of years. John Farrak is here with us now to talk about the analysis and what he found. He's a reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin media investigative team. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
So about how many people get arrested at Lambeau on your average game day?
Oh, on average, it's about six or seven. And now that varies, obviously, year to year. There's been a couple years where it's been a little bit closer to eight or nine. But last year, for example, we had 67 arrests, and there were 11 games, if you count the playoff game against the Cowboys. So last year was down, actually. A number of arrests were at one of their lowest levels over the last decade. But again, just even a couple years earlier, they were closer to 90. So you never know, what's in store when it comes to unruly fan behavior at Lambeau Field.
And disruptive behavior doesn't necessarily get someone arrested. It might get them booted from Lambeau. What kind of numbers are we talking about there?
Well, last year, I think they were closer to about 290 ejections. And again, that was down from a couple years earlier. There's been a couple years where it's been close to even 400. But oftentimes, this is one of the things that the police told me was that if there's somebody that's really causing disruption at the stadium, the first goal of the ushers is to get that fan removed, from the stadium. And oftentimes what happens, and this was pretty common in some of my analysis here, was that it's that those fans that are being taken out of the stadium, that just totally lose control of themselves, and it spirals downward for them. So going from, it goes from an ejection to an arrest very quickly.
And what kind of things usually lead to somebody being ejected and maybe subsequently arrested?
Oftentimes, it's things such as using profanity, obscene language, middle fingers, swearing, all kinds of expletives toward fans, toward police, towards other ushers throughout the stadium. Occasionally, you'll have a fist fight in the crowd. Other times, it's just pure drunkenness. Somebody that goes into the bathroom and, just to be blunt, I mean, is urinating in the sinks. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things are situations that I've seen. The other one too, I was surprised to see as many people that were picked up with marijuana, sneaking marijuana into the stadium or trying to get marijuana into the stadium, and they're frisked at the gate, or you know, they're able to sneak it in somehow, and you know, and some incident happens later in the game, and the police find marijuana in their pocket.
We should put the numbers in perspective. Capacity, there's about 70,000. I believe it's always full. And we're talking low double digits. This doesn't sound like a huge number of people with that number in the backdrop.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. You know, just when you put it in perspective, you're talking a percent or a small fraction of a percentage. Nonetheless, some of the games, for example, you'll have double-digit arrests and ejections. Bears games, for example, I think 9 of the 10 Bears games over the last decade all had at least 10 arrests or more. And a couple of those games had at least around 50 ejections. And there was the Vikings playoff game from 2 years ago. That game had 91 ejections in it. So there's situations where there are a fair number of fans that just lose control and have to get thrown out of the stadium.
Talking to John Farrick with Gannett, Wisconsin Media, looking at how they keep law and order in the stands at Lambeau Field. You mentioned which games you see more people ejected and arrested. John, who is it? Are these locals, Packer fans from elsewhere, or the visiting team?
Well, last year, for example, it was a lot more fans that were coming from out of town, and by out of town I mean from outside Green Bay or Brown County. For example, I think last year there was only 6 residents from the Green Bay area that were arrested, but there was 22 fans that were arrested that came from outside of Wisconsin. So, I mean, in that respect, you're seeing fans from California, Texas. I remember a handful from New York. 7 or 8 from Illinois, and a handful from Michigan, and I remember there was a Patriots fan that got arrested as well during the Packers win over Tom Brady last year. So you are seeing a lot more fans from out of town, and I think part of that gets into the fact that they're coming to Lambeau Field kind of with a party atmosphere or coming for the party experience. These are not season ticket holders, Rob. And they're more apt to overindulge in alcohol, as one of the fans I interviewed told me. And things just kind of go downhill from there. And next thing they know, they're being hauled away in handcuffs and facing an $880 fine.
And those season ticket holders, those season tickets might have been handed down through generations, or they might have spent years on waiting lists to get that. Is the perception among maybe law enforcement that, hey, these are people who don't want to risk losing those tickets?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. And I know that was true with a couple of season ticket holders that I interviewed as well for my series. And so the situation is the fans that are getting arrested very oftentimes are buying the tickets online or, you know, through, you know, somebody else. And these are not season ticket holders, you know, that are getting hauled out of Lambeau Field wearing handcuffs. But it's just somebody else that's coming to Lambeau Field for a one-time experience. And it's certainly a memorable one, but one they'd probably rather forget.
Now, when I see these fan behavior standards at Lambeau, they seem like they're making a pretty clean experience in the stands compared to what you hear from, I don't know, Philadelphia, Denver, Oakland sometimes. Are there NFL-wide requirements, or is Lambeau doing something on its own here?
Honestly, on that one, I think that there's standard behavior, or, you know, kind of standard rules. There's a code of conduct that that the Lambeau Field and the Packers adhere to, and it's publicized and posted on their website. That's expected of fans throughout the country. But my experience, and just from talking with other people anecdotally, is that at least on the East Coast, fans are a lot more rowdy and unruly in the stands. Whereas in Green Bay, the expectations, there's a higher expectations for fan behavior. And by and large, most fans get it, season ticket holders get it, and they are behaving. And it's just, you know, when you get 70, 75, 78,000 fans together and you get a fair number of people that have been drinking pretty heavily, had a long time to tailgate, and came to Lambeau Field from far, you know, far away. You know, those kind of are part of that recipe for disaster.
Briefly, John, as we wrap up, what's maybe the weirdest thing somebody got kicked out of Lambeau for in your reporting?
Well, I thought that I thought the situation where there was this fan at the Patriots game last year, and he was they saw him messing around, jumping on cars out in the stadium parking lot. And he was walking around throwing fluids on car hoods, and turns out that he had broken into somebody's tailgater's car and was throwing Jello shots and alcoholic pudding shots onto cars. And that man was from Fond du Lac, so it's not somebody that was flying in from California or Texas, but it's just somebody right down the road from Lambeau Field.
The great Jello shot bandit. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
That was John Farrick, reporter for the Gannett, Wisconsin Media Investigative Team, with us to talk about his stories analyzing fan ejections and arrests at Lambeau Field. You can find the full story at PackerNews.com. We've got it linked, I think, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Reports of the death of the communal or family meal have been not totally exaggerated, as it turns out. According to a new report from the Food Marketing Institute, nearly half of all meals and snacks are now eaten alone.
As for breakfast and lunch in particular, most of us are eating them alone these days, if we're eating them at all. Yeah, some people are flat out skipping lunch. According to a 2012 report, we eat them at our desks or we just don't eat them.
Roberto Ferdman joins us now. He covers food and economics for the Washington Post Wonk blog. He recently wrote a piece on the rise of dining alone in America. Roberto, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, back in 1985, you report, the New York Times said that it's no longer odd to dine alone. What are the latest numbers on that today?
Isn't that funny, considering how we eat today? The numbers, you kind of pointed to them. This is the most recent in what's really a series of research on eating alone, the instances in which people alone, or the frequency with which people eat alone. This particular one found that more than half of all eating opportunities are had alone. So snacks at your desk or snacks on the go, breakfast at home or on the go, lunch and dinner. But others kind of support this exact notion. In fact, the U.S. Time Use Service shows that the majority of Americans report regularly eating alone. And these numbers have all increased dramatically over the past few decades and are seen by experts within or market industry analysts as only rising going forward. The headline of this piece was "The Most American Thing There Is, Eating Alone." And that's not because you're American if you eat alone, or that there aren't other things like, I don't know, hanging a flag outside of your house that might not be more American. But eating alone is really at the center. It's at the intersection of all these different happenings, these trends in the United States that have to do with a lot more than just food.
Right. Part of the story here is that a lot of us, more of us, are living alone, too.
If you look back to the 1960s, something like 13% of all households had a single occupant. In the 1970s, it rose almost to 20%. But today, that number is almost like 30%. So close to a third of all households have a single occupant, meaning that you're eating alone if you're at home in 30% of households. So that has had a huge effect on the number of people that eat alone and the number of times that people eat alone. Part of what's driven the rise of single households is the fact that we're no longer getting married as quickly as we used to. Something like 1 in 5 25-year-olds have never been married. That number is significantly higher than it used to be. People aren't really getting married until into their 30s today, which means that through their 20s, they're either living with roommates or they're living by themselves. And because of both of these things, they're eating a lot of meals by themselves.
And for the people that do live with someone else, be it a family member or a roommate, is dinner sort of the last holdout?
So if you look at, I've actually written about the family supper and the rise or fall of it, and it's held fairly steady. This particular study found that something like 67%, or roughly two-thirds of all dinners are had with company, so with other people. That doesn't mean they're had with family. It could be had with a friend, had with a roommate that isn't family. But what this shows is that dinner is in some ways more sacred than the other meals. But I think that that has to do with the fact that we're very busy, and we're very busy leading up until dinner. Dinner is kind of the one time that we can sit down with others and have a meal that we aren't rushed or aren't skipping, as you mentioned before.
And
Roberto.
I was going to say part of the story of being busy is that a lot of us are eating lunch at our desks at work. Veronica and I eat lunch at our desks often in the same office. So I don't know if we're technically eating alone or not, but we're not alone in that. This is getting more and more common, isn't it, Roberto?
It's far more common. It's something like 60% of lunches or 65% of lunches, I forget the precise number, but are now either had at your desk or not had at all. So you're right to point out that people are eating at their desks, which is kind of sad. There's a reason why people refer to like sad desk lunches or sad desk salads. In fact, there's even a little bit discussion around like what's okay to eat at your desk. And the fact that we're even talking about that shows how common the practice is. But it's also that people are skipping these meals. We don't have time for them.
That seems unusual to me. I mean, maybe I'm late to the party here, but it seems as though people don't usually skip lunch. They skip breakfast. So what does it say about our society that we're too crunched to even eat lunch at all?
Well, this is actually something that's become more and more common. It's not that we aren't eating between breakfast and dinner. It's that we might be replacing lunch with two smaller snacks. I would say smaller meals, but which are effectively snacks at different points in the day. So you might have a banana, a fruit, or some sort of food to keep you going, and then have something else in between what would be your lunch, but the lunch that you're not having, and dinner. Breakfast, however, is actually the meal that people skip most often. I think that people are just too pressed for time. And most recently, we've seen that some of the research around the importance of eating breakfast in terms of what it does for our health is kind of under fire. So who's to say that the people who aren't eating breakfast aren't somehow healthier for skipping the meal?
Talking to Roberto Ferdman with the Washington Post about his recent piece on eating alone in the United States. Most of us are doing it. We're doing it more. We're eating lunch at our desk. We're eating home alone. Some of us are just skipping meals altogether. You can let us know your experience at 800-642-1234. Do you eat many meals alone? Or do you go out of your way to make sure you eat at least some of them with other people? Do you see a backlash either starting now, Roberto, or maybe in the future where people are saying, hey, this is terrible. We need to start eating together again.
I mean, in terms of a movement, there isn't a comprehensive movement to overcome this. I don't, and basically everyone I've spoken to agrees that this is pretty much headed in one direction. It's the direction in which we eat alone more often than not, and people will continue to replace certain meals, not necessarily the same exact meal every day, but for snacks because we don't have a lot of time. And you know, this is playing out in all sorts of interesting ways. For instance, within the fast food sector, for which breakfast has become really, really important. You see McDonald's extending its breakfast throughout the entire day. You saw Taco Bell, last year beginning to sell breakfast and really focusing on things that are portable, because people basically won't buy things that aren't portable. And that really speaks to how important it is to eat these days. It's basically something that we need to do throughout the course of our busy days, but don't sit down and take the time to enjoy.
Now, you said this is a phenomenon that's at the nexus of a bunch of things that are going on in American culture, like marrying later and living alone longer. Are there similar trends, though, going on in other countries, or is the U.S. Sort of the forerunner on this one?
This is something that's happening elsewhere as well. The pushing back, basically, of marriage is not just happening in the United States, though it's happening in the United States a little bit more drastically than it is elsewhere. And the crunch, the time crunch is happening elsewhere as well. So if you look, for instance, to Europe, this is the sort of thing that's being noticed as well. But America as it is, or the United States as it has been for other things, is kind of leading the pack in this in this trend of eating alone. But it's more of a stigma, or it was more of a stigma in the United States than it has been elsewhere. So I think that's why it feels more significant. Even anecdotally for me, I think about the instances in which I began to eat alone and how it's become normalized over time. I was overcoming, you know, the social stigma attached to it, which is part of why I brought up that 1985 article. Clearly, they're talking about eating alone and how it's becoming okay, because a lot of people fear that it's not.
Well, and you even write that restaurants are starting to accommodate some solo diners in different ways. Can you tell us about that?
So the traditional way to accommodate solo diners is to house them at the bar. And there are instances in which restaurants have actually broadened the number of seats that they have at bars. But then there are also restaurants which have just incorporated bench-like seating. Jose Andres in Washington, D.C. Is one whose new restaurant, in fact, caters exactly to that. He has bench-like seating so that people can come and sit as they come and go on their own. Long tables that don't seat a particular number of people are another perfect example. Bench-like tables or where diners can sit with people that they don't know. There are really many different ways to accommodate them. There's even a bit of a philosophy around the comfort of eating alone that involves only sitting one placemat or one place setting at a two-person table, so that when someone sits down, you don't have to take away the second place place setting. Which, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. I agree, but at the same time, it might have a kind of significant philosophical impact on how you feel about sitting down, because you're sitting down to a table that's for one person instead of a table that was for two, but sadly you couldn't convince someone else to come eat with you.
We're talking with Washington Post reporter Roberto Ferdman about the rise of dining alone at home or out or at work here in the United States.
And you can join us. Does this sound a bit like what's going on in your life? Maybe breakfast and lunch alone, maybe skipped altogether. Do you feel okay eating by yourself in a restaurant? Is it something you're comfortable with, maybe that you didn't used to be? What is that experience like for you now? And do you think we're losing out on anything by eating alone? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Washington Post reporter Roberto Ferdman about the rise of dining alone in America.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound like your life? Are you eating more meals alone, whether at home, at your desk, at work, at a restaurant, or maybe just breakfast and lunch alone? Or do you skip those, as more and more people are doing? Do you wish you had meals with other people more often than you do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We go to our callers now. We've got Ann on the line in Wauwatosa. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm 51 years old. I'm a very social person, but I love eating alone because at a moment's notice, I can go to any restaurant I want, even a restaurant that I just want to try out. I like sitting at the bar, but, you know, sometimes I bring a book and I just want to sit and read. I just think of all the spectacular meals I would have missed out on if I had to, oh, darn, wait for somebody to, you know, go with me. And so I love going by myself.
Have you always felt that comfortable doing it, Anne, or did you have to build up to it and now you're comfortable?
No, you know what? I've always felt comfortable doing it. Like I said, I like to go to movies by myself because if it's really bad, you can just get up and go. You don't have to have a consensus. And I have a lot of friends who, you know, oh, I don't like that kind of food. And I don't, you know, I can go and try because I love all different kinds of food. So, you know, and I have met some wonderful people because you're sitting there alone. You're kind of a target. Hey, what are you doing? People talk to you. What are you reading? That kind of thing.
Anne, that's terrific. Thank you so much for sharing your experience about that. She feels very empowered by doing it, and she has she's stressing there the freedom of choosing where you want to go, when you want to go. Definite perks, don't you think, Roberto?
I kind of had the urge to clap on air, but I held myself back. No, I think it's actually very astute of her, and a lot of people don't don't realize that the distinction that they're making when they decide to not do something by themselves. Eating out is a perfect example, but people tend to weigh doing something on their own with doing it with someone else, when in reality, if you're sitting alone at home on a Friday night, you're making the decision between doing the thing and not doing the thing, both of those things being done alone. So I think it's fantastic that she likes to go out and eat and go to movies alone. I feel exactly the same way.
And Anne mentioned sometimes she does this with a book, and that's important to me if I'm dining out alone, or actually eating at home alone for that matter. I want something to do. I want something to keep me occupied. I got to have a book or something, maybe a tablet in front of me. Is that a trend we're seeing more out in public?
That's very much a trend, so much so that there are restaurants that are either accommodating people who come in not just with books but with tablets and I guess the larger iPhones, essentially Apple products, which Apple, I'm sure, loves. I think that both speaks to the growing acceptance of the trend, but then also in kind of a weird, perverse way, the fact that there's still a stigma around eating alone, because part of that is occupying yourself. But I think often, and I hope I'm not just projecting, but maybe I am projecting, part of that is also bringing something and putting it next to you so people know that,
oh, yeah,
yes, you are alone, but you're also with this book.
Right. If you're just sitting there, you're just a guy sitting there. If there's a book, it's like, oh, that guy's doing a thing. So, yeah, no, that's me too, Roberto,
See, but
for
isn't
sure.
there something wrong with that we feel we need to use books and smartphones as sort of armor for dining out alone,
yes,
where someone like Anne can just, it sounds like, just go and sit there and be comfortable?
Yeah. More power to Anne.
More power to Anne. I think there's definitely something wrong with it, but that doesn't mean I don't still do it.
As do most people, I betcha. Well, we're talking right now to Washington Post's Roberto Ferdman about the rise of dining alone in America. Nearly half of all meals and snacks are now eaten alone. And we want to know if you find this in your life at 800-642-1234. How comfortable are you with dining alone? What do you think about this trend? And we'll go next to Anna in Anisac, Illinois. Hi there, Anna.
Hi there. You guys are actually leaning right into my next comment. Since with social media, I feel like people don't necessarily feel like they're eating alone when they go out. People usually post where they're at, what they're doing. So just because people are out supposedly eating by themselves, maybe they don't actually feel like they're alone or by themselves. Hmm.
Right, and that's a relatively new thing. Thanks for bringing that up, Anna, that you may be physically alone at a table in a room, but you don't feel alone. So maybe that's the difference in comfort, Roberto.
Well, what's funny about that is that there's actually something in sociology, there's actually a name for it that's evading me at the moment, but what it centers around is the idea that we are kind of at the center of our own movie. We're the main character in our own movie, but we're not the main character in other people's movies. So what that means is when we go to a restaurant and we're sitting by ourselves, we're sitting there playing on our phones thinking, you know, my God, everyone's noticing that I'm here alone. But the truth is that people don't actually notice that you're there alone. They might notice it in passing, but no one is sitting there worrying about, you know, me who's there with my book that's sitting flat on the table.
Anna, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go to Judy in Appleton next. Judy, hi.
Hi. I have a question as to whether other people have the same problem that I have with walking into a restaurant and requesting a table for just one. I always, even if I think about it ahead of time, find myself saying just one or only one, instead of assertively saying one, which is what I would say if there were two or three.
Do you feel like it's almost an apology, Judy? Oh, only one?
Yes.
Yeah. Judy, thanks so much. Thanks for calling in. Roberto, there's still, probably in public or in private, we feel a little like we're letting somebody down if we're eating by ourselves.
I appreciate that comment. I actually haven't given that any thought, but I'm pretty sure that every time I've eaten alone, I've said just one. So I'll never say that and not think about it from here on out.
I was trying to mentally do it in my head, and I think she's right. You would always want to put something before the number one, something to practice there. And we're going to go next to Jen. Jen joins us in Vernon. Jen, hi.
Hi. I was just thinking that most people, when they do choose to eat with other people, are typically on their smartphones or tablets, and they're not interacting with the other people. So it's pretty much the same thing as eating by themselves.
Ah, you're flipping that around a little and looking at the phenomenon of being alone together with other people, which is worse or better, I guess. So what do you think about that quandary, Roberto?
That's an interesting. First of all, I'm curious to know where you're eating out, because while I see people eating, sitting at tables, playing on their phones, I don't know if the majority of people around the table are. But actually, there's a bit of an annoyance with this habit, to the point where there are restaurants in both D.C. And New York, kind of where I shift back and forth from, that force patrons to put away their phones, or even to give in their phones when they first arrive at the restaurant. So they're addressing that very problem, forcing people to be present, not just with their food, but also with the people at their table. It annoys me. It's, you know, I grew up in a household. When I was young, we didn't have tablets and phones and stuff. But I still, when I go home to dinner, bringing out your cell phone is not okay.
Jen, thanks for the call. Roberto, briefly, as we wrap up, looking at this research, is this motivating you personally to try to eat more meals with other people, in or out?
I actually think that my takeaway from this is to embrace eating alone, to understand that it's actually it's only something that is bizarre historically or traditionally here in the United States, and is something that's accepted elsewhere in Europe in particular. I've had actually the complete converse, or opposite reaction to that. I want to embrace eating out in the same way that I want to embrace going to the movies alone, as one of the callers said, and doing other things alone, because they're okay.
It's a fantastic place to leave it. Roberto, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been my pleasure.
That was Roberto Ferdman, reporter covering food and economics for Washington Post's Wonk blog. He joined us to talk about the rise of solo dining in the United States.